The first speaker you will hear will be Professor George Bisharat of the UC Berkeley School of Law, and then consecutively Adam Horowitz and Philip Weiss, two of the authors, co-authors of the Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation. So let us go to that.
Thank you so much for coming, and welcome, Adam and Phil. It is an urgent priority for all of us that Israel's impunity from international law, from its violations of international law, come to an end. And that is why the book project, launched by these two amazing writers, Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss, together with Lizzie Ratner, who is not here, is so important. You probably are all aware that Phil and Adam are co-editors of Mondo Weiss of Blogspot, which is one of the most interesting, provocative, and important sites of information and analysis on Middle East politics that you can find. If you've not yet partaken of it, you absolutely should. They have taken the landmark Goldstone Report, and they've edited it to readable proportions, and they've joined it with incisive commentary by a variety of prominent analysts, and are here today to put this important document into wider public circulation. Now, that may seem like an odd jump from ending Israeli impunity to appraising a book tour by a couple of writers. Indeed, it shouldn't fall on the shoulders of people like Adam and Phil to play a role in ending Israeli impunity. But it does, because our public officials have not only failed to stop Israeli violations of international law, they have been actively complicit in those violations. It is our government, perhaps more than any, that has spun the cocoon of impunity and enabled Israeli officials to escape liability for their wrongs. And I'm sad to say that this is true of Susan Rice, President Obama's UN ambassador, just as true of her as it was of John Bolton and Zalmay Khalilzad, who held that position during the Bush administrations. So recent WikiLeaks releases have revealed how actively Susan Rice, politicked behind the scenes at the UN to subvert the Goldstone Report, as well as other UN investigations of Israel's violations of international law. And I'm sure you are aware that Congress has also actively attempted to undermine the Goldstone Report through a number of resolutions that condemn it and that purport to direct US policy to block its effects. The report established that Israel likely committed war crimes before, during, and after the attack on the Gaza Strip in December and January of 2008-2009. Israel's ruinous siege of Gaza, imposed years before the invasion, collectively punished its residents in violation of international law. During the attack, Israeli troops killed civilians without justification, wantonly destroyed civilian infrastructure and private homes, and used weapons illegally. For example, Israeli troops targeted and destroyed Gaza's last functioning flour mill. Israeli armored bulldozers razed the chicken farm that provided 10% of Gaza's eggs, burying 31,000 chickens in rubble. Israeli gunners bombed a raw sewage lagoon, releasing 200,000 cubic meters of filth into neighboring farmland. Repeated pinpoint strikes on a water well complex destroyed all of its essential machinery. These are just some of the facts that led the mission, the Goldstone mission, to conclude in its report that Israel's objective in the attack was, in quotations, to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, radically diminish its local economic capacity, both to work and to provide for itself, and to force upon it an ever-increasing sense of dependency and vulnerability, unquote. Since a January 2009 ceasefire, Israel has maintained its illegal blockade, keeping relief supplies and construction materials from Gaza, and thus guaranteeing continued Palestinian suffering. And yet, in a pattern that is consistent with the past, whether we think of Israel's serial invasions of and 18-year occupation of Lebanon, whether we reference the detention without trial, torture, and assassinations of Palestinians in the occupied territories, or whether we reference the colonization of the West Bank, no Israeli political or military leader truly has suffered any legal consequences for these acts. That's what impunity is: freedom from consequences for violations of law, whether domestic or international. Israel's impunity, ultimately, is good for no one. Those who suffer worst, of course, are its victims, both past and prospective. Israeli Jews themselves cannot possibly benefit from deepening regional and global enmity against them. We, those of us in the United States here, Israel's enablers in countless ways, also reap a terrible harvest for our unconditional support for Israel. Finally, the global community in its entirety suffers if some of Israel's illegal practices, such as targeted killings, are followed by other nations, such as ours, in effect threatening to rewrite international law through violence and in a way that distorts and undermines the purpose of international law, international humanitarian law in particular, which is to protect civilians and to minimize damage and harm to people, even in times of war. Impunity for one state undermines the very legitimacy of international law. It does so because law has no credibility if there are people who live above the law and can engage in actions that others cannot without consequence. International law, we should be aware, protects the weak and strong alike, and we ignore its continuing abuse at our peril. Now, in the face of all of the power that is aligned in Israel's support, especially in this country, it may seem like tilting at windmills for people like Adam and Phil to travel around the country promoting this book and to work on their blog and the like. What is the point? Can these efforts to raise American consciousness about the realities of Israel's destructive behavior make a difference? The answer is absolutely. Ideas and perceptions matter a lot. For decades, ever since the 1942 Biltmore Program, the Zionist movement, and then subsequently the State of Israel, have recognized this and have identified the strategic centrality of the United States, and in particular, the American public. Vast efforts and sums have been expended to ensure that the American public is exposed only to a, I should say, not just an Israeli narrative, but to a particular Israeli narrative. Needless to say, the Goldstone Report does not fit that narrative easily, and that is why it has been the subject of such withering attack by Israel and its supporters in this country and elsewhere. Nonetheless, things are changing. It is, after all, a tough challenge to convince the world that the sky is red and to persuade people not to believe what their eyes plainly see. So perhaps we are, as a public at least, in this country, starting to come to our senses. Beyond increased public awareness lies the challenge of our seemingly hopeless political class. We have all watched the Arab Spring in amazement and admiration as Arab citizens from all walks of life have risen up to challenge sclerotic, anti-democratic regimes. Perhaps it is not such a preposterous notion to suggest that what we need here is an American Spring. After all, our political system, once the envy of the world, seems to have fallen into crippling dysfunction. Somehow, in this American Spring, I'm seeing Adam Horowitz and Philip Weiss at the head of the pack. Please welcome them warmly to our community. And then buy their book.
Adam Horowitz.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks, Professor Bisharat, for that incredible welcome. And thank you, Mecca, for this invitation. Your work has been a model and an inspiration for years, and it's an honor to be here. For those who don't know us, I'm Adam, and that's Phil. And we're going to talk tonight about our book, The Goldstone Report. I'll go first and then Phil. I'll read some parts and talk about some of our experience around it. And then during the question and answer, which we really want to make sure there's time for, we can talk about whatever you like. The website, the book, anything. I usually start by reading a part from the book, and I will just give a brief intro because I know this crowd is really familiar with the situation in Gaza, the Goldstone Report, but something that you may not know is when the fact-finding mission first traveled to Gaza, led by Judge Richard Goldstone, Judge Goldstone actually set up a parallel process to the fact-finding mission. And that process was based on the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa, which he had witnessed. And through that, he set up open sessions in Gaza and in Geneva, because he wasn't allowed to enter Israel, where he allowed anyone to come and tell their story. Anyone who lived through the fighting, anyone who lived through Operation Cast Lead. And his belief was, and this was based on his experience in South Africa, that one of the first steps towards reconciliation and towards justice is simply the ability to tell your story and to have your story be heard. And these stories were not included in the Goldstone Report, the official document released by the UN, but they were published by the UN, and we were lucky enough to get access to them and incorporated some into the book. So I'm going to start off by reading one of them. This is a 30-year-old father of three named Khaled Abdrabo. On the 7th of January, at 12:50 p.m., the Israeli army bulldozed our garden, and the Israeli tanks were positioned in front of our house. They started yelling at us through the speakers and asked us to leave our house. So I came out along with my wife and my three children, Suad, 8 years old, Samar, 4 years old, and Amal, 3 years old, and my mother, who was 60 years old. We were all holding white flags. The Israeli army was stationed right across from our house, so we stood by the entrance and we were holding flags, white flags. The tanks were 7 meters away from our house and they did not say anything to us. There were two soldiers sitting on top of the tank. One of them was eating chips. The other one was eating chocolate. We were looking at them like, you know, what are we supposed to do? Where are we supposed to go? We were then surprised because all of a sudden a third soldier came out of the tank and started shooting at the children with no reason, no explanation, no pretext. My daughter, 3 years old, her stomach was hit and her intestines were coming out. I was really amazed. How could a soldier be firing at my daughter? So I carried my daughter, 3 years old. She could hardly breathe. Like I said, her stomach was wounded. My other daughter was also wounded in her chest, so I took both of them, Samar and Amal, inside the house. My wife and my mother and my other daughter, Suad, were still outside. But all of a sudden, my wife joined me, carrying Suad. Her chest was wounded by many bullets. My mother, 60 years old, she was carrying a white flag, and she was also wounded on her forearm and also in her stomach. So we were all inside the house, and we started calling the ICRC, the ambulances, anybody to come and rescue us, but nobody came. All of a sudden, we heard an ambulance, but then all of a sudden, nothing, silence. Later, we saw that the Israeli soldiers had asked the ambulance drivers to come out of the car to undress, and they bulldozed the ambulance using their tank. My daughter Amal, 3 years old, she was dying, and by the end of the day, she did die. My other daughter, 8 years old, like I said, her chest was riddled with bullets. She passed away. My other daughter, Samar, she was riddled with bullets. Her back was open. She was not breathing through her nose, but through her lungs, and she was telling me, "Dad, help, help," and I couldn't do anything. She was thirsty. I was afraid if I gave her any water, something would happen. I didn't know what to do. My mother, 60 years old, she was also dying. I was helpless. I didn't know what to do for my children. There was my daughter dying in front of me. So I carried her and left the house, even if I had to die myself, because I couldn't take it anymore. I carried my daughter and left the house again, so that that soldier, he might as well just kill my daughter and kill me myself. Because I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't let my children die in front of me. Like I said, that's a piece that I usually begin with when I talk about the book, and I do that for several reasons. One of those reasons is just to take us back to what it was like in that moment in the winter of 2008-2009 and help us just recenter how we can imagine what it must have been like inside of Gaza. Another reason I share that is because, you know, oftentimes people will ask us, why did we put out a book about a UN report? And there's several reasons for that, and we'll talk about it. But really, one of the reasons, and in the Goldstone report itself, it does an amazing job at raising the voices in this conflict that we never get to hear. As much attention as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict gets in its way, even in the mainstream media, we so rarely get to hear the voices of the people directly affected, directly living under siege, directly living under occupation. And the Goldstone Report is an incredibly powerful tool at doing that. Another reason that we put out the book and why we feel that the Goldstone Report is important, and Professor Besharat got to this a little bit, is that I think at its heart, and the reason why I think the report has been as controversial as it has been, is because at its heart, it is a call for accountability. And unlike previous reports that have either been put out by the UN or other agencies, it charts a clear path towards that accountability. And it's that path that the US, the Obama administration, and others are trying to stop. Just to recount a bit, and we had some of this in the introduction, the report does find that both Israel and Hamas were guilty of war crimes during the fighting in the winter of 2008-2009, and possible crimes against humanity. I think one of the most sort of grievous charges against Israel is their use of disproportionate and indiscriminate force in Gaza. I know a lot of people will have questions about the op-ed that Judge Goldstone wrote, and we'll talk about it a little some, and we can certainly talk about it more during the Q&A, but one of the charges he made in that op-ed was that he no longer believes that Israel had a policy to target civilians. One of the interesting things to remember is that that's not a charge that's actually made in the report itself. What the report says is because of using this strategy of indiscriminate and disproportional force, Israel made it impossible to protect civilians. And that's a different charge, but that's a war crime. One of the things that the Goldstone Report does that I also think is so important is that it puts that policy in a context. That Israeli policy did not begin with Operation Cast Lead. And in this way, the Goldstone Report, I think, serves as one of the best primers that we have on this most recent phase of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I want to read from a part of the official Goldstone Report where it talks about this policy and where it came from. Israel's operations in the occupied Palestinian territory have had certain consistent features. In particular, the destruction of buildings, including houses, has been a recurrent tactical theme. The specific means Israel has adopted to meet its military objectives in the occupied Palestinian territory and in Lebanon have repeatedly been censured by the UN Security Council, especially its attacks on houses. The military operations from 27 December to 18 January, which is Operation Cast Lead, did not occur in a vacuum, either in terms of proximate causes in relation to the Hamas-Israeli dynamics or in relation to the development of Israeli military thinking about how best to describe the nature of its military objectives. A review of the available information reveals that while many of the tactics remain the same, the reframing of the strategic goals have resulted in a qualitative shift from relatively focused operations to massive and deliberate destruction. In its operations in southern Lebanon in 2006, there emerged from Israeli military thinking a concept known as the Dahiya Doctrine, as a result of the approach taken to the Beirut neighborhood of that name. Major General Gadi Eisenkot, the Israeli Northern Commander Chief, expressed the premise of that doctrine. This is a quote. What happened in the Dahiya quarter of Beirut in 2006 will happen in every village from which Israel is fired on. We will apply disproportionate force on it and cause great damage and destruction there. From our standpoint, these are not civilian villages, they are military bases. This is not a recommendation, this is a plan, and it has been approved. The report then goes on to quote Israeli leader after Israeli leader saying that what Israel did in Dahiya, it was going to do in Gaza during the lead up to Operation Cast Lead. And the report concludes, the mission does not have to consider whether Israeli military officials were directly influenced by these writings. It is able to conclude from a review of the facts on the ground that it witnessed for itself that what is prescribed as the best strategy appears to have been precisely what was put into practice. And I know that Professor Bisharat already sort of outlined this, but I think it bears repeating that what that strategy meant in Gaza was the purposeful destruction of the civilian infrastructure, what it takes for the daily livelihood of Gaza. And that include, and again, I'll read the list of the chicken farms in Gaza, the flour mills, the sewage plants, the water wells, what it takes daily life to continue, in addition to over 1,400 Palestinians killed. And I think, and again, this is a quote that Professor Bisharat read, but I think it bears repeating again, where the report concludes that the attack was a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. And you have to remember that Israel's rationale was that it was entirely security-based defensive attack. The Goldstone Report finds otherwise. I think one of the other, you know, in talking about the Goldstone Report as a primer or Operation Cast Lead as being reflective of this moment, and again, Professor Bisharat talked about this too, I think it's important to remember the U.S. role in all this. If you remember back to the attack on Lebanon in 2006, it was Condoleezza Rice at the UN who was actively working against a ceasefire while the rest of the international community was trying to put an end to the fighting. At that time, she said that we were witnessing the birth pangs of the new Middle East. Similarly, in Gaza, and Israel tried to exploit the time between the Bush and Obama administrations, and people were calling out to Obama to speak out against the onslaught in Gaza. And although he was speaking out about other international issues, he refused to talk about this. And then Israel was mindful enough to end the fighting just days before his inauguration, so he wasn't put on the spot immediately. And I think the flotilla is another example of this too, where you can say Israel used both indiscriminate and disproportional violence and killing 9 of the activists on board, including a U.S. citizen, and still the United States was silent. So while this most recent period, going back to 2006, seems to be a period marked by horrible massacres, U.S. silence, and I would agree, Israeli impunity, I think this has also been an incredibly inspiring moment as well, because with each of these attacks, with each of these moments, we've seen the grassroots movement for Israeli accountability growing by leaps and bounds. And I'm just going to finish my portion here by reading a bit from the introduction that we were lucky enough to get from Naomi Klein, where she addresses this point. While Western governments continue to protect Israel from accountability, insisting that economic sanctions are off the table, and even welcoming Israel into the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, civil society around the world is filling the gap. The findings of the Goldstone Report have become a powerful tool in the hands of the growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is attempting to pressure Israel to comply with international law by using the same nonviolent pressure tactics that helped put an end to apartheid in South Africa. Thanks to this crucial book, many more people will be able to read the text of the report and make their own judgment about whether Israel has been unfairly singled out or whether, on the contrary, it is finally being held to account. One of the most remarkable responses to the report came in January 2010, when a coalition of 11 leading Palestinian human rights groups called on Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to investigate Goldstone's allegations that they were complicit in war crimes. This was despite the fact that the Israeli government had refused to launch an independent investigation of the far more numerous allegations leveled against it in the report. Theirs was a deeply courageous position, one that points to what may prove to be the Goldstone Report's most enduring legacy. While most of us profess to believe in universal human rights and oppose all crimes of war, for too long those principles have been applied in ways that are far from universal. Too often we make apologies for the crimes of our side. Too often our empathy is selectively deployed. To cite just one relevant example, the UN Human Rights Council has frequently failed to live up to its duty to investigate all major human rights abuses, regardless of their state origins. So while the Council boldly created the Goldstone Mission to investigate crimes in Gaza, it stayed scandalously silent about the massacres and mass incarcerations of Tamils in Sri Lanka that were alleged to have taken place within months of the Gaza attack. This kind of selectivity is a gift to defiantly lawless governments like Israel's, since it allows states to hide behind their critics' hypocrisy. But now a new standard has been set. The Goldstone Report, with its uncompromising moral consistency, has revived the old-fashioned principles of universal human rights in international law. Enshrined in a system that, flawed as it is, remains our best protection against barbarism. When we rally around Goldstone, insisting that this report be read and acted upon, it is this system that we are defending. When Israel and its supporters respond to Goldstone by waging war on international law itself, characterizing any possible legal challenge to Israeli politicians and military officials as lawfare, they are doing nothing less than recklessly endangering the human rights architecture that was forged in the fires of the Holocaust. One of the people I met in Gaza was Ibrahim Moamer, chairman of the National Society for Democracy and Law. He could barely contain his disbelief that the crimes he had witnessed had not sparked some kind of an international legal response. Israel needs to face war crime trials, he said. He's right, of course. In a just world, the testimonies collected in this book would not merely raise our consciousness, but they would be submitted as evidence. But for now, in the absence of official justice, we have to settle for what the survivors of Argentina's most recent dictatorship have called popular justice. The kind of justice that rises up from the streets, educating friends, neighbors, and family until the momentum of its truth-telling eventually forces the courts to open their doors. But it all starts with reading the report. So I'll leave it at that.
Good evening. And I also want to thank Mecca for having us out here. It's just great to be honored by an organization that has been so inspiring to us, and just, you know, a sterling example of moral commitment. I don't know how many of you know Judge Goldstone's story, but two of the important moments in his story are that before he went into Gaza in June of 2009, he had dreams of being kidnapped by Hamas. He had a dream about being kidnapped. And I also went in at that time, and the only way we think of Gaza in the West is as this terrorist entity. And one understands why he had those that dream. And when he came out of his 2 weeks in Gaza, or 10 days in Gaza, he said that he was going to have nightmares for the rest of his life about what he saw. And his dream of being, his nightmare of being kidnapped had been replaced by a feeling of complete solidarity with a people whose dignity had been assaulted. And the basis of international law is preserving human dignity. That's at the heart of international law, is really a spiritual principle that he had seen demolished again and again in Gaza. Now, as I say, I went into Gaza at the same time, and so when I helped to edit this book, I could remember, I saw the things that he was documenting, and I want to just name a few of these things to convey to you what it was like to go into Gaza. And even today, Gaza has still not been rebuilt. So you could go, if you can get in now, you can see the evidence of this onslaught 2.5 years later. I saw the American school destroyed, completely destroyed by bombs. There was a sprinkler going in the grass, but the school itself had been destroyed. The Israelis knew it was a school. I saw the Adam read from the Abd Rabbo family experience in northeast Gaza, near the border to Israel. And the this man whose two children were killed, two daughters were killed and the third maimed on that day, and I believe his mother also was attacked. He described an ambulance being bulldozed. I saw that ambulance 6 months later, under the rubble, destroyed. And so Goldstone also saw that ambulance. So when Abd Rabbo, is that Abd Rabbo? And when he described that ambulance being bulldozed, there was evidence before the judge's eyes. And I also saw the family home that had been hit by white phosphorus and was blackened throughout, and their child was still unhealed from the scorching flames of this, a weapon that's illegal to use in any sort of civilian setting, had been used in a civilian setting, had destroyed most of this family and left this girl scarred for life with scars that were preventing her from growing. And finally, 6 months later, she was brought to the United States. I believe that these scars have been removed. I think that she is developing. But this was the case 6 months after the fact. And I know that from one of Goldstone's appearances, one of the things that is going to give him nightmares for the rest of his life is the fact that he had seen, he said this at Yale. It's not emphasized in the report, it's in some of the matter that was included with the report, the photographs. There was satellite imagery that they had of the Gaza Strip, and Goldstone saw in fields in the south of the Gaza Strip that Israeli tanks had carved a big Star of David in a field, in destroying a field. They had created this Star of David. And This was a very emotional experience for Goldstone because he is a Jew. And one cannot remove the fact that he is Jewish from the reception of this report, just as one cannot remove Adam's and my Jewishness from our significance in this solidarity struggle and the journalism that we produce. It's not everything about what we do, and it's not a trivial piece. It's a small but crucial piece. And Goldstone, and I say, when one of the ways I convey my experience of the Gaza Strip was that when I was a kid, my mother had six children. She'd like to say one for each of the millions who were destroyed in the Holocaust. And she only bought used books in our house and used clothing. I grew up with that, only used things, secondhand. And she, when we were teenagers, bought us new copies, all six of us, of Roman Vishniak's photographs of the Warsaw Ghetto. It was important enough for her to spend, I don't know, $50 each on a book of photographs of the Warsaw Ghetto to engrave upon us the Jewish experience in Eastern Europe. And this was our cultural, religious memory that was being inscribed in us. And spontaneously, when I was in the Gaza Strip, all I could think about were those images that she had given me, that she refuses to deal with herself when I talk to her about the experience of the Gaza, the people in Gaza. And I want to tell you that one of the most vivid experiences we had when we were in the Strip was meeting the head of a library, a woman named Reem Abu Jaber. And this library, a beautiful library for the children of Gaza City, had been hit by Israeli munitions and artillery during the assault. And she passed around to this group of us who were meeting with her some of the armaments that had fallen on this library. And it was a delegation of probably 25 Americans in this room. And Reem is a very impressive woman. She's highly educated. She could be working in London or the Emirates. Her sisters, I believe, are in London and the Emirates. But she's chosen to stay in Gaza to help her people. And as she spoke to us, strangers, she broke down and said, because she can't get out of the Strip. She can't even go to her sister's wedding in the Gulf. And she broke down, this was, again, a few months after the Gaza assault, and said, why have we been abandoned by the world? This is the worst conditions have ever been in Palestine, and the world doesn't care. And that sense of loneliness is something that we saw again and again in Gaza, a sense of being cut off and abandoned by the human family. And that sense is what I believe motivated Goldstone. Now, I said to Reem on that occasion that while things had never been so bad in Palestine, which I accept the Palestinian accounts of, that things were getting better in the West. And I could point in that room to Medea Benjamin, the head of Code Pink, who was there. And I could say to Reem, Medea did not go near this issue until this happened. And to her incredible credit, when this happened, Medea threw herself into, Medea, who had worked on third world issues all her life, but came from a family with some Zionists in it, and you know, the usual prohibitions that exist inside the Jewish family had operated on Medea. When this happened, she threw herself into this issue. She's been there many times. She's been a leader on this issue. And similarly, Naomi Klein had largely avoided this issue. She wrote the introduction to our book. And Naomi, when she went to Ramallah a few months after this onslaught, she apologized to the people of Palestine for her cowardice. And also in that room was Norman Finkelstein, the scholar of the Israel-Palestine situation. And I said to Reem, I know that it's not, these people are not suffering anything like the degree to which you are suffering. But Norman has lost jobs over this. Norman is an isolated figure. And I said something that I've heard a number of times around this solidarity struggle, which is that those who express solidarity with the Palestinian people will get a taste of the Palestinian experience. They're not going to get a full dose of the Palestinian experience, but they will get a taste of it. And I think that if you look at what Judge Goldstone did when he was so moved by what he saw, to write this incredible report, really a landmark document of international law and certainly of this conflict. When you, what befell him was also a small portion of the Palestinian experience, because he found himself smeared, isolated, attacked. He was called a traitor inside the Jewish community. The American government came down on him. Here's a guy who is a complete insider. You're never going to meet more of a insider than Judge Goldstone. And he was battered. He was excommunicated. And it was a terrible experience for him. Now, Norman Finkelstein and Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss and Barbara Lubin are people, and many of the people in this room, and George Bisharat as well, and Sid Schneid, and Jeff Blankfort, we are people who are more used to this type of experience of grassroots engagement. Judge Goldstone was not used to that. And what he found was this just incredible onslaught against his work. And lo and behold, as Adam pointed out a few weeks back, he retracted part of his report in this really shocking op-ed in the Washington Post. And I think that, and that op-ed has acted to undermine some of the force of this report. So one has to ask, you know, why are we still pushing the report? Is the report a success despite this? And I would say absolutely, it has been an incredible success, the report, in raising awareness about this issue. And I would just emphasize, if I were talking to Reem now, this person who felt so lonely, and I'm sure she still feels incredibly lonely in Gaza, I could point to many things that have happened since June 09 that the Goldstone Report has played an important role in, and they include the flotilla coming a year later. They include the flotilla that's being planned now. They include the Gaza Freedom March, in which I participated at the end of 09, and that Medea Benjamin and Code Pink played such an important role in. And they include the international effort now to isolate Israel through the boycott movement. That has been aided by the Goldstone Report. And it includes the international effort to recognize a Palestinian state. You know, 60 years after Arabs were promised a state, 60 years in which we have Pakistan getting a state, India getting a state, Israel getting a state, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kosovo, everyone gets a state. You know, the international community recognizes this as this great failure. And so there's this effort to recognize a Palestinian state. This, too, is part of the Goldstone effect that is taking place. So I just want to emphasize that the report has played this incredible role in, I think, taking the Palestinian experience and making it something that others can share in. And the racism, the hatred, the demonization, the assault on dignity that has been perpetrated against these people for so long, this report has helped to break down. And so more and more people around the world are willfully tasting some of the Palestinian experience.
And that, well, last was Phil Weiss of Mondo Weiss blog. I recommend you look at that.